From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the November 2021 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Secrets of the Supermarina. Many visitors to Bletchley Park are familiar with the story of breaking Enigma and reading German and even Japanese codes, but equally important work was done on Italian ciphers. Not only were the codebreakers able to read Italian naval messages before and during the war, but this information was used to decisive effect in the battle for North Africa and the ultimate defeat of Italy in 1943. In this It Happened Here episode, Bletchley Park's research historian Dr. David Kenyon reveals the secrets of one of Bletchley Park's lesser-known decryption successes. As always, grateful thanks go to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
We talk a lot on this podcast about German codes and breaking Japanese codes, but one of the less known areas of Bletchley Park's work was breaking Italian codes. Before GCNCS even came to Bletchley Park, when they were based in London, they were working on Italian codes. But can you tell us why Italy was of interest to GCNCS?
I can, and it's interesting that a huge part of GCNCS's focus in the pre-war period was towards Italy, and this kind of gets overlooked by a lot of the people who focus on Enigma and the Germans in particular. But in terms of Britain's strategic position in the world in the 1920s and particularly the 1930s, the Mediterranean is of vital importance to Britain. You have the Suez Canal and the routes to India and to the Middle East, British possessions in Palestine and Jordan since the end of World War I, Egypt itself, of course. So activity in the Mediterranean and any threat to British interests in that area is of vital strategic importance to the UK. You can contrast that in some ways with, even after Hitler's come to power in Germany, German expansionist interests in Eastern Europe or Czechoslovakia or wherever, they're a worry, but they're not vital to the empire in the same way. So right through the 1930s, Britain is keeping a very close eye on the Italians, and GCNCS is contributing to that by reading their codes. And it's not just a theoretical threat. One of the things Mussolini does is he builds up the Italian navy. And by the late 1930s, they have not an enormous navy, but a very modern navy, a very well-equipped navy. And so they're a genuine threat to the Royal Navy in the Mediterranean.
How successful was GCNCS in breaking these Italian codes pre-war?
It's kind of a game of two halves, because pre-war, GCNCS has done very, very well with Italian codes. And it's kind of the opposite with the German codes. There's a famous remark that no German messages have been read for over 20 years in 1939. By contrast, Italian naval codes are pretty thoroughly understood by GCNCS. During the 1930s, the Italians are using book systems where you have, you know, a dictionary of numbers that represent the words in your message. You look up the number and then you have an additive book where you add a second number to that first number. This is a deciphering system that we've talked about in previous podcasts. The Italian Navy is doing that. The British Navy are also doing that. It's what the Japanese do. So it's quite a common method of enciphering messages. But the Italian books that are being used by their navy in particular, GCNCS has managed to unpick those pretty thoroughly. And there are several reasons for that. One is the Italian code procedures are quite poor. They don't change the additive books, for example, often enough. You need to kind of change the numbers in your book fairly regularly, because otherwise your opponent can work out what they are. They also have this particularly bad habit where, in order to give practice to their cipher clerks on board ships, they would encipher editorials from the newspaper and send them by wireless to the ship, and then the signaller on the ship had to decrypt them. And this was supposed to give practice to the operator. What it actually does is, if the British in Rome go and buy the daily newspaper, it gives them a perfect crib for the code. So it was actually offering anyone who wanted to a really good way into Italian codes. So in the 30s, Britain is reading huge amounts of Italian traffic. And this is important as way back as early as 1935, because you have the Abyssinian crisis, so-called, in that period, when the Italians are expanding into modern Ethiopia. And there's a point where it looks like there might be a war against Italy. Interestingly, from a GCNCS point of view, and this is a little bit of a diversion, but we've talked previously about the emergency list that was drawn up in 1939 for codebreakers who could come on board for the war. And this is when Turing is recruited and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Denison actually made an emergency list in 1935 of people who had expertise in Italian in case there was a war with Italy in 1935. But that list obviously never got used because that war never happened.
But shows they recognised potential
threat. It shows they recognised it was a thing. And actually, they read a lot of the Italian traffic at that period. Similarly, once the Spanish Civil War starts in 1936, the Italians are supporting the nationalist forces in Spain quite heavily, and there's a lot of Italian naval activity around Spain. And again, GCNCS and the Admiralty are able to follow those Italian ships around and see what they're up to using code breaking. So by the time you get to 1938, Italian naval traffic is a big part of what GCNCS does. And again, we've talked before about the so-called Captain Ridley shooting party, the group that come to Bletchley during the Munich crisis. And the Munich crisis politically is all about what Hitler might be doing in Czechoslovakia. But the British government's worry is that a war with Germany is one thing, but if that war happens, a war with Italy is likely to follow. And so their main focus is on Italy. And actually, if you look at the numbers of people who come to Bletchley for the first time, that team who come in 1938, a significant number of them are working on Italian codes, which sounds a bit weird when you're worried about a war with Germany. But once you unpick it, it makes perfect sense.
Do we know how many of them?
We don't know how many in 1938, but we do have the figures for when they came back to Bletchley in 1939. And at that point, Naval Section has 11 people working on Italian codes and only two working on German. Obviously, the German section got a lot bigger and the Italian section didn't get bigger at the same rate. So within a couple of years, obviously, the German section is much bigger. But certainly at that initial period, the greater part of the effort is being put into Italian stuff.
Does that reflect their relative inability to break German codes as much as the importance of the Italian codes?
It does, yes. I mean, the comment earlier about no German messages being read for 20 years or whatever, there is a perception at that point that Enigma is more or less unbreakable. Mm-hmm. They proved this wrong very quickly, as we all know. And machine ciphers in general are much more of a challenge. These book systems are much kind of better understood to what everybody's using. And so the methodologies for breaking those systems are much better understood.
La dichiarazione di guerra è già stata consegnata agli ambasciatori di Gran Bretagna e di Francia.
Italy joined the war in June 1940. Can you tell us what happened next?
It's interesting. I was saying about during the Munich crisis, there's this idea that the Italians will jump on board the moment Britain is distracted by war with Germany. What Mussolini does, he actually waits until he thinks the war's about to end. France is about to collapse. The Italians invade France from Italy in the south to give Mussolini a kind of claim in the negotiations afterwards and a claim to victory. His ambition is that the war will end almost immediately and he'll have won by not doing anything. But of course that doesn't happen, and a fully-fledged war breaks out between Britain and Italy. And fighting starts almost immediately because Italian possessions in North Africa, in Libya, are right next to Egypt. And further south, in Eritrea and Abyssinia, again, you have British and Italian possessions very close to each other. So war with Italy becomes a real fighting war very, very quickly. But having described the Italian use of codes as a little bit faulty previously, the one good thing they've done is they have a complete set of naval code books that they've kept in store. And the idea is the moment a war breaks out, you get rid of all the books you've been using during peacetime and bring out these new books. And they do that on 1st of June. And that renders all the work that GCNCS has been doing on Italian codes null and void. You know, all of that progress on those codes is lost and they have to start again from the beginning.
From scratch.
From scratch.
Wow.
And the consequence of the change of Italian code books is that GCNCS never really get back into those systems. There are people working on them, but they never make a huge amount of progress. It's not like the Japanese books, for example. And there's a figure that they were able to produce 4,000 decrypts from Italian book codes. And 4,000 sounds quite a lot when you say the number, but if you compare it to the number of Enigma messages that were broken or even the Italian machine ciphers that we're going to talk about in a bit, it's a very small number.
That's 4,000 the entire war?
The entire war.
Wow.
Yeah, which in Bletchley terms is a pretty small number. Mm. So the Italian book systems are no longer accessible in a meaningful way. And we were talking 4,000 breaks for the whole war. And if you think that Bletchley at its peak is breaking 2,000 to 3,000 Enigma messages a day,
gosh,
you know, it's a pitifully small amount by comparison.
But book codes aren't the only encryption method they're using.
That's true. The Italians are using books. They also use Enigma a little bit. And particularly during the Spanish Civil War, the Italians have used Enigma to communicate with the Germans and with the Spanish. And Britain and France were involved in breaking that Enigma traffic using rodding, the technique that they developed in the late 30s. That's because those machines don't have the famous plug board on the front of them. They're different from the German military machines. So it's a sort of different sidelight of Enigma. There is a famous occasion when an Italian Enigma message is broken in March 1941. And this message revealed that the Italian fleet was going to sea. And when the information was passed on to Admiral Cunningham in Alexandria, he was able to intercept the Italians. And the naval battle of Cape Matapan in March 1941 was a consequence of that. And it tends to be that if people have heard of Italian naval code breaking, they think of Matapan and of that Enigma message. But that Enigma message is one of relatively few that they send. And so it's kind of atypical in that sense. It was strategically very important because the victory that Cunningham was able to achieve at sea was huge. But it wasn't typical of the kind of Italian code breaking that Bletchley was doing.
Normally, you see, one didn't ever know, and this is what we can't get people to understand, that if you're a code breaker, you didn't necessarily know what the messages were saying, that once you broke one message for a day, that the setting which the operator was using would cover the rest of the day, and you just took it through to a machinist who ran it all off, so that you might break a message which said nothing to report, and you wouldn't know something later on, which was just what General so-and-so wanted or somebody else wanted, because we just didn't know, because that was not the way need-to-know worked. However, Matapan was different. The first message, a tiny message, said, today's the day minus three, X minus three. Oh, goodness, the Italians are going to do something. What is it they're going to do? And this was, of course, 3 days before Matapan, so that was the 25th of March, 41, and that was when we got the message. So then we heard what was going to happen on D-Day minus two the next day. We were up all night, of course, and then waiting for the next day, D-Day one, and then D-Day. So everything had to get out to Cunningham in time. Well, of course, it was a marvellous battle because it was at a very bleak time, March 1941,
That's right, yeah.
And, of course, traditionally, a naval victory is very good for the British public. And Churchill was over the moon, and he said that there was nothing like it, no fight since Trafalgar, and Cunningham was as good as Nelson, and so on. And then came the message through from the Admiralty at midnight, tell Dilly we have won a great victory in the Mediterranean, and it's all thanks to him and his girls. So that, of course, imagine what that was like to a bunch of 19-year-olds. We were terribly pleased about that.
The other thing that happens at the beginning of the war in June 1940 is that the Italians reorganise their military commands. And this is where this thing we've referred to as the Super Marina comes into being. This is the Italian naval headquarters. They create three organisations. There's the Super Marina, which manages the navy, the Super Esercito. Listeners will have to excuse my Italian pronunciation, which was the army, and the Super Aero, which was the Air Force Command. So you have these three service headquarters, and they're all subordinate to the Comando Supremo, which is Mussolini and his chief military commanders. We're interested in particular in the Super Marina because they adopt a mechanical cipher system for their communications with the ports around Italy, basically. They set up a network of about 20 to 25 stations, and communications are sent between them using a new cipher machine.
This isn't the Enigma you've just been talking about. This is an entirely different machine.
This isn't the Enigma. This is a new machine called the C-38M, which is a machine designed by Boris Hagelin. And it comes into force with the Italians in late 1940. And indeed, in December 1940, Bletchley Park identify that it's the cipher system that's being used on this particular batch of traffic.
How would they have done that? How do you see this is a different cipher system? What would they have noticed in the traffic that tells them it's different?
It's about traffic analysis. You would look at the way the message is formatted. All messages, for example, you need things called indicators, which are code groups that tell you, for example, in a book code, which page of the book to use, of the additive book to use, and things like that. So you can look at the external characteristics of the message, even though you can't read it, and you can say, right, this one's probably been created using this particular code system, this one's been created using this code system.
Right.
I mean, an obvious giveaway versus the book codes is most book codes rely on numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have a five-digit number, you'd add another five-digit number to it and create a third number. So your message will be numerical digits, whereas this traffic is alphabetical characters.
And this is coming through on Morse via
it's
radio.
It's being intercepted by wireless Morse. And they can also see by the call signs and by a little bit of direction finding that it's not coming from ships, it's coming from these headquarters bases. It's coming from Naples, it's coming from Taranto, it's coming from Trieste and from the headquarters in Rome. So by looking at who's communicating with who and what the messages look like in their sort of external character, I mean, they may not have been able to say it's this specific machine, but they would be able to say it's a new cipher that's being used by this particular group of headquarters and it has these certain characteristics. And then you kind of go away and you fall back on your experience and go, what cipher systems exist that are likely to produce message content that looks like this? And again, we've talked about how when German military Enigma, it's not a case of we've never seen an Enigma message before. Bletchley Park bought an Enigma machine back in the 20s. So the external characteristics of the traffic, even if you can't break it, you've probably got a pretty good idea of what kind of system created it.
Right.
And again, we'll see that the machine that the Italians are using was a variant of one that was produced commercially before the war.
Uh-huh.
So none of these things are particularly secret to anybody. They're all systems that your enemies are likely to know about.
It's being stated here today that possible revolt inside Italy itself will make it necessary for the Germans to occupy the entire country. The Evening Standard today says, it seems certain that the Italian fleet was sent to sea on German orders, possibly in order to cover a fresh dispatch of German troops to Libya. We can imagine what feeling the resulting fiasco must cause in Italian ports. Italian sailors will blame their German masters. German sailors will bewail the fate which condemns them to risk death in Italian ships. The blood brothers will be at each other's throats.
You've talked about the external characteristics of the message and the details of that, but this machine that was new or based on a previous machine, can you tell us a bit more about what was the Hagelin machine like?
Well, the machine the Italians adopt in 1940 is produced by a chap called Boris Hagelin. He's a quite famous cipher system inventor. He was born in 1892 in Russia, in Baku, in fact, right in the middle of nowhere. His father worked for Nobel, who were the prize people, who were a mining and engineering firm. And so he was an employee of Nobel in Russia. After the revolution, they all got kicked out of Russia. So Boris and his family moved to Stockholm to carry on working for Nobel. And it happened that Nobel conglomerate owned a small cipher machine company. This was set up by a chap called Arvid Dam, who'd come up with a number of mechanical cipher machine concepts in the 1920s. He died in 1927, and Nobel placed Boris Hagelin in charge of this little engineering company and said, you know, carry on producing these cipher machines. It's not clear that Hagelin necessarily had any particular experience prior to that in ciphers particularly. But when he took over this company, he started looking into how to do it. And he obviously had a flair for it because he took some of Dam's designs and came up with his own machine that used the concepts and patents that Dam had set up and added his own inventions to it. And he produced a machine in 1925 called the B-21. Rather unimaginatively, his machines were called A machines, B machines and C machines. And the Italian one is a C machine. This B machine has some of the characteristics of the later C machines. When things really change is in the late 1920s when he's approached by the French government who say, we need a cipher machine, but we don't want something like, for example, the printer Enigma that was in circulation at that point. We don't want a huge desk-mounted machine. We want something that a soldier can use out on the battlefield. And their kind of design brief, if you like, was we want a device that will fit into a tunic pocket and can be used out and about outdoors. So Hagelin set about designing a machine to meet this French specification. And his C-35 machine is the first machine of this new design. In terms of what it looks like, all of these series of machines are similar. And they're, if you imagine a sort of a metal box about 6 inches square, you know, 15 centimeters square, and probably 4 inches, 10 centimeters deep. Imagine a very fat paperback book or maybe a hardback book. It's about that sort of size.
But metal, like one of those sort of money tins you get with a little lock on.
Yeah, one of those little money tins. That was a very good example. But it's big enough to fit in a large coat pocket. And one of the other clever designs is the underside of the machine is actually slightly curved. There was a strap, leather strap around the box that held it shut. And you could undo the leather strap, put the whole thing on your thigh and buckle it up underneath. And with the curved underside, it would sit on your thigh securely. And then you could use both hands to operate the machine. So if you were in a trench or a field or whatever, it was really convenient to operate. And then you could pack it up, put it in your pocket. So it looks like quite a small, compact, basic device. But actually, the encryption it creates is quite sophisticated. How it works, superficially when you look at it, you open the lid and there are six rotors or wheels at the front of the machine. And each of them has letters on it in the same way as you think about the rotors in an Enigma, for example, except there's six of them. And the message key, the starting setting for a particular message, is created by setting each of those wheels to a different alphabetical position. In terms of how these machines work, the first one is a C-35, but then you have a C-36, you have a C-38. There's a family of machines that all work on the same basic operating principle. What varies amongst them is some of them have more wheels on the front than others, but they all basically do the same thing. So I'll tell you about how the C-38 operates specifically, which is the one the Italians had, but the C-35 and the others are all basically the same.
And brace yourself, listeners, the next 5 minutes might get a bit geeky, but bear with us because it is fascinating stuff.
I will attempt to explain it in the simplest language I can manage. So when you look at the machine, you have these six rotors on the front, each of which has a series of alphabetical letters around it. And you set up the machine to send your individual message by positioning these rotors to a particular setting.
Or like you would on an Enigma.
Like you would on Enigma, except you've got six wheels instead of three. So you would have a starting key, if you like, which is six letters long. Actually, those wheels are not the same size. Well, they're the same size, but they have fewer positions. They're not all 26 letters long. You have a 26 position wheel, a 25, a 23, a 21, a 19, and a 17. What that means is because they're what they call mutually prime, they're based on prime numbers apart from the 26 and the 21.
And the 25.
For those that are listening, go closely. The point is, the variation in the numbers means that you don't get a regular stepping of the wheels. When they turn irregularly relative to one another, even if you just step one position each time. And because they turn over like an odometer in a car. The right-hand wheel goes all the way around there, the same as it does in an Enigma. But the varying length of the wheels makes the sequence less regular. Mm-hmm. So you have these six wheels. Next question is, what do the wheels actually do? Well, if you open up the back of the machine,
the lid flips up like a box.
Again, the analogy is with an Enigma. You've got a carrying case, mm-hmm. which you remove, and then you have a series of settings which are immediately visible to the operator and can be changed for every message, a bit like the rotors on an Enigma.
Right.
Separately, there's a little keyhole, and you can unlock the machine and lift up the lid to the proper internal workings.
To reveal the gubbins.
Exactly. Inside there, you have a device which the internet tells me is referred to as a squirrel cage, which got me excited. Unfortunately, it has no squirrel in it. Well, perhaps fortunately for squirrels, it has no squirrel in it. But what you have to imagine is, I was trying to think of a way to describe this that people could picture in their heads. If you've got the inside of a toilet roll, so you've got a cardboard tube, mm-hmm. and you get a box of pencils and a couple of rubber bands, and you attach pencils to the cardboard tube.
All the way around?
All the way around, parallel with the direction of the tube. So imagine you get 26 pencils and strap them around with rubber bands. Mm-hmm. So you've got that in your head.
Yeah, so it almost looks like a pipe made out of pencils.
Yes. In the machine itself, this is a cage of steel rods. There's sort of a pierced circular disc at either end, and then lots of these rods all going around, 27 of them, in fact. And how the encryption works is, if you imagine we take our cardboard tube and we push all the pencils so that they're flush with one end of the cardboard tube. Mm-hmm. Now, if I were to push a certain number of those pencils so that they stuck out of the end of the cobble tube. Mm-hmm. What I can do is I can create a cogwheel, effectively, with the protruding pencil ends.
Yeah.
But I can change that cogwheel. I can push all the pencils back flat again, and then I can push out a different combination. And I can create a cogwheel with any number of between 1 and 27 sticky out pencil ends.
Mm-hmm.
And then if that wheel is used to turn a second cogwheel, it will turn that second cogwheel the number of places equivalent to the number of pencil ends that are sticking out. So what's happening is that cage, the squirrel cage, creates a variable offset. And if you imagine the second cogwheel you've got represents your alphabet of 26 letters, if you set that wheel to A and then you cycle your squirrel cage all the way around once, it will turn your letter wheel away from A the number of places to reflect the number of
teeth you've pushed
teeth
out
or pencil ends or whatever that you have pushed out.
Yeah.
So it creates a variable offset for the cipher. But the next problem you have is, how do you decide which pencil ends stick out, which rods have moved to the left in the machine so they have an effect? And this is where the wheels at the front come in. Because each of those wheels at the front has adjustable teeth on it. And you can adjust each tooth so that it either sticks out, it's what's called active, or it's folded over and it's inactive. And this is a technology that's used on the Lorentz machine later. I mean, this is the thing about cipher systems. They all borrow from each other. So it's no surprise that a lot of these machines have characteristics that are comparable between them, because all these people are thinking about the same things and they're looking at each other's devices. So what you have on your wheels at the front is that middle wheel, for example, that has 23 positions on it. It's got 23 of these little teeth, and they can either be sticking out, active, or not. And then to go back to our squirrel cage, our rods, each of those rods has a metal tab attached to it. And what that means is when the cage turns, if that tab comes into contact with a sticking out pin from the wheel at the front, that will push the rod to the side and make it active, will create a spoke for the cogwheel. Is this making sense so far?
Yes, I think I'm with you. What I'm getting is there's a lot of potential variables in this
machine.
There
are a lot of potential variables. So what happens is there's a crank handle on the side of the machine. You've got your six wheels at the front, and according to how you've set up those wheels, a varying number of pins will be sticking out from those six wheels. You crank your big handle, your cage at the back turns around one full revolution, and a number of bars equivalent to the number of pins that are sticking out of the wheels at the front will be pushed across and will create the offset for the cipher. That's the complicated bit. From an operator's point of view, what you do is you have a wheel on the left-hand side, which sticks out of the machine, which has the alphabet around it. You turn that wheel to whichever letter you want. So you spin that round to say B, and then you crank the handle on the other side. This is why you've got it strapped to your leg, because it takes two hands to operate it. You crank the handle. The internal mechanism goes round. It changes B, advances it through the alphabet, a pseudo-random distance created by the pins.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a little printing device that prints the subsequent cipher letter onto a little thin paper strip.
Now to one of our reporters in the Mediterranean for news from Germany's Axis partner. Go ahead, Rome.
Hello, NBC. This is David Anderson speaking from Rome. With the fall of Benghazi, a number of questions have been raised in newspaper circles here in Rome. Primary among these, perhaps, is what are the intentions of the British forces under General Wavell? Are they going to try to round the coast of Cyrenaica into Tripolitania, or are they merely going to strengthen their newly acquired positions? About a week ago, well-informed circles in Rome were of the opinion that the British would remain at Benghazi if they succeeded in taking this stronghold. It was felt that any advance into Tripolitania would spread out the forces of General Wavell too much, and the risks of defeat from a combined Axis force would be too great. The reports here in Rome today speak of continued action south of Benghazi. Whether this means that the British are going to attempt to take the whole of Cyrenaica or continue their drive toward Tripoli is more than can be said here tonight. The Italians are still pointing out that Jeroboam stands as an Italian oasis in the desert.
So actually, the operator with these teeth and tabs and wheels and pins and things, the operator isn't really handling any of that. They're turning an alphabet wheel and something prints out the side.
Basically, yes. All he needs to do, or he or she needs to do, is set the six wheels at the front to the starting setting for the message. And then you take the wheel at the side. You go, right, D for Dave, crank, A crank, V crank, I crank, D crank. And every time you crank, the cipher letter will have been printed on the piece of paper and this little strip will feed out, which is actually really convenient.
Yeah.
And similarly, because there's a reciprocal alphabet in the machine, that because the internal cog has the alphabet the opposite way to the external wheel, deciphering is exactly the same as enciphering. You do the same thing with the cipher letters. So you turn the wheel to the cipher letter, crank, and the plain text letter will be printed on the paper.
As long as you've got your wheels in the right position.
As long as you've got the same starting setting as the guy that sent the message to you.
Mm-hmm.
Great. So it's a really simple machine. It's a lot easier than an Enigma because you don't need a pencil and paper. You don't need to look at lights coming on. You don't need any electricity. The thing is entirely mechanical. If you run out of paper strip, you're in a bit of trouble. But inside the lid of the case, you see, they typically have this big roll of paper stored inside the lid. So you've got plenty of paper to use. So from an operator's point of view, a really clever device, and it is reasonably secure. The problem with the cipher is that what you're actually doing is because once you've set the pins on the wheels at the front, the starting setting that you select, that 6-character starting setting, from that point, each time the machine clicks forward, it will click through a single string of encryption positions until it gets back to the beginning again. That cycle is actually just over 101 million characters long.
Wow.
So it's quite long. 101,405,850 is the full cycle length. But once you've set the pins in the machine and set the tabs on the squirrel cage, that 101 million character cipher string, as we call it, never changes. All you're doing by changing the starting setting is starting at a different place along your 101 million character long list.
So it is to some extent predictable then?
It is. And the one thing that is a real weakness is if you start at the same position as someone else, or your message overlaps in the sequence with someone else's message, then you've created what's called a depth. And code breakers love depths, because if you've got two letters encrypted with the same additive letter, basically what it's done is it's taken a letter and it's advanced through the alphabet a certain number of places. So you can think of that as, if you give the letters A to Z, the values 1 to 26, you can think of it as a letter plus another letter equals your cipher letter. So if you have two messages that overlap, then it becomes quite easy to break. So the trick is to make sure that none of your cipher operators use settings that are anywhere near each other so that their messages don't overlap. And that's something that the Italians try and do. What's interesting about this machine is we talk about Enigma not being a secret. The Hagelin system is not a secret either. The French have bought a system from Hagelin, the C-35 system, which they're using. In 1940, the US government buy a very similar machine from Hagelin as well, a thing called the M-209. And if you look on eBay or whatever nowadays, if you see Hagelin machines, you'll see M-209s, because the US government manufactured over 140,000 of them.
Wow.
And they carried on using them right up until the Vietnam War. So they were a really, really common cipher system in American use. And the Americans accepted that they were vulnerable, but they were secure enough for the level of communication they wanted to do with them. We always talk about Scherbius, who invented Enigma, being run over by a carriage while still penniless and never making any money. Mm-hmm. Boris Hagelin actually made lots of money and lived to a ripe old age, but we'll come back to that later on.
So you're saying the Italians and the Americans were using effectively the same cipher machine?
Yes. And this is obviously an advantage for the British and the French and everybody else, because the way the machine works is pretty freely understood. What you have to figure out is how you can work out the individual key settings of the machine, and then how, once you've worked out those settings, how you can break the system, basically. Mm-hmm. Understanding how the system works is not the same as being able to break it.
Yeah. Did Bletchley Park have a Hagelin machine that it sort of took apart or understood the workings of, or was it all theoretical?
I've seen no evidence that firmly says whether or not they had one. But the fact that they were buying Enigmas in the 1920s, any cryptographic organisation worth its salt will be buying any machines that are out there. And they would certainly have had access to how the French and American machines work. And Hagelin is selling these systems commercially pre-war, so it's likely that they had a pretty good understanding of how the device worked. But again, as I say, that's a mile away from, you know, how do you read the traffic?
One of our messages in the hands of the enemy may lose a battle. But if that message is cryptographed, the enemy will lose enough time figuring it out to make the information useless. To help you cryptograph more effectively, this converter, the M-209, has been put into use throughout the Army. There are several models of the M-209. All operate the same way. To see how, let's encipher the simple word go. Whenever you encipher, be certain that the encipher-decipher knob is at C. Set the letter G on the indicating disc opposite the indicating index.
Can you tell us how the Italians used the Hagelin machine?
This machine is not being widely used by the Italian Navy. It's not on every ship, for example, like Enigmas were on German ships. It's only used for a relatively small number of users, probably 20, 25 headquarters, something like that. And the way they use it is there are three things you can set on the machine. If you unlock it all and open up the lid, the first thing you can do is you can position the tabs on the sliding bars in the cage at the back, because if you put the tab in a different position, you can decide which of the six wheels at the front moves the tab and which doesn't. And each bar had two tabs on it that you could slide to different positions. So you could have that bar become active when different wheels touch it. So that's the first thing. That's what they call the W setting. And then you have what's called an X setting, which is where you get the wheels at the front and you adjust the little pins that stick out of the wheels at the front. And this is something you could do on the Lorenz machine later as well. Those pins can be active or inactive. So at the beginning of a month, the senior officer would come in, he'd unlock the machine, he'd set the W and the X settings of that machine. What that has done is it's created that code string that we were talking about, that cipher letter string of 101 million characters. And that will stay the same for everybody for the whole month. What they did then was they issued a book to each of the operators. And because, as I was saying, you don't want the messages to overlap, they set a limit and they said, you can't have a message more than 500 characters long. And so if we only use settings that are at least 500 characters apart in our 101 million string, then no one will overlap with anybody else. For reasons known only to themselves, they picked settings that were 2,497 places apart, which is a bit odd because they could have chosen them slightly randomly distanced apart, but they didn't. And that gives you about 40,000 possible starting settings. And they printed the 40,000 starting settings in a book. Each page would have rows and rows and columns of starting settings, and they're all jumbled up, they're randomized. They all had the same book, but each operator was told, for this month, you're only allowed to use these particular pages in the book and these particular columns and rows on those pages. So theoretically, each operator of the machine has his own batch of predetermined settings that only he can use. And the theory was that he crossed out each one when he'd used it in his book so that he didn't use it again. And this, in theory, makes the system secure because no messages are overlapping with anybody else's messages. You're all using different bits of the key string, and that's all good. The problem you have is you also need to send the starting setting to the guy at the other end, the recipient of the message. So this is where you have this indicator that I talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. And there, basically, they'd get the page in the book, the column and the row numbers, which indicated which setting you'd chosen. And they would take those, and they had another code book or code sheet that allowed them to convert that number or mask that number. And then they would turn it into alphabetical letters using A is 1, B is 2, C is 3. Mm-hmm. So basically you get this little block at the beginning and the end of the message, the indicator block. And the recipient would get that block. He'd unpick the fairly simple encipherment. And then he'd look in his book for whichever setting you'd used. And then he could set up his machine, the front six wheels of his machine, to that setting. And then he just starts cranking and putting letters in.
And it'll print out.
And it'll print it out. Perfect. That's how it works. But the problem with this is that this system was never properly observed.
You use the word theoretically so many times. I'm thinking, when we talk about Enigma, we always talk about operator weaknesses.
It's exactly that. We come back to this problem that busy people make mistakes. Busy people are lazy in their operations. And it became apparent fairly early on that depths and partial depths, so overlapping messages, start to occur, even with the best efforts of the Italians to prevent them. Or you get repeat messages on the same setting because the guy, you know, he used one last time, but he forgot to cross it out, and so he's used it again. There's all sorts of human error that creeps in. Although it's set out to be quite secure and all the regulations are written and all the books are printed, as is always the case when we have these conversations, that all falls down when the war starts and you give it to real humans to try and operate it. Mm-hmm.
So we have a book for the starting settings and a book or a sheet for the indicator. Did Bletchley Park or did the Allies ever manage to get hold of copies of those in, I don't know, pinches or captured documents or something?
I'm not aware that they did. There has been a certain amount of discussion by Italian historians and elsewhere about this very topic, because when it became apparent that Hagelin had been broken, there was something of a scandal in historical circles in Italy. And actually, an Italian historian wrote a book where he claimed that an Italian admiral had told his mistress about it, and his mistress was a spy, and that allies had found out through his mistress and all of this. It's now clear that this isn't true. There was also the question of whether settings books were captured, for example. I'm not aware that any were. There's a chap who used to be the head of the historical section for the Italian Navy, who I've had several conversations with about this, because he was looking for what you've described, a pinch in the Mediterranean, which might have given all this away. And he drew a blank. And one of the interesting things, this is a side issue to what we're talking about today, but we've talked elsewhere about the pinch program that Bletchley launched to capture Enigma information off weather ships and all those sorts of things. Actually, because they managed to break the system by analysis in 1941, which we'll talk about in a second, Bletchley was very wary of pinches being carried out in the Mediterranean, because once they were able to read the system, they didn't really need anything to be pinched. And so it tends to be a case of deliberately avoiding commando raids and other things on places that were operating haggling, because Frank Birch and the rest of the naval section explicitly said, don't attack anywhere that has haggling, because we're reading it already. If you go in there and pinch a load of books, the Italians will then think the system's possibly compromised and then they'll stop using it.
And they've been burned before by all the book codes being changed.
Yeah, exactly. It's a story for another day, but you have this whole thing about Fleming setting up 30 assault unit and these commandos who are tasked with pinching. They all go off to the Mediterranean in 1942 in connection with Operation Torch, the invasion of Algeria. But Alan Bacon goes with them to the Mediterranean. And this is my interpretation of it. The evidence is quite thin, but my interpretation of it is that one of Alan Bacon's jobs is to keep 30 assault unit away from anywhere where there might be haggling equipment so that they don't inadvertently mess the whole thing up by capturing something that we don't need to capture. But as I say, that's a story for another day. I'm not aware that they capture any important pinches as part of this process. I think they mostly figure it out for themselves.
So in that case, if Bletchley Park didn't have a handy settings sheet from whatever time for haggling or books to rely on, how did they manage to break the haggling traffic?
Well, they didn't have a settings sheet, but they did have a Bill Tutt.
Which is, let's face it, better, surely.
Yes. Regular listeners to this podcast will know that we're big fans of Bill Tutt. We think he's one of the great unsung heroes of Bletchley Park.
Tell us about Bill Tutt.
Well, I need to go look back a little bit, because in the spring of 1941, it becomes obvious that this traffic is being sent between senior Italian naval headquarters, and reading it would be really, really useful. So a chap called Captain Morgan,
of rum fame.
Jerry Morgan is taken from his job in Hut 5, a military section, and is told to set up a research section. Bletchley Park has had a number of research sections. The Enigma research section is the famous one from 1939 that had Twin and Turing and Dilly Knox and Welshman. This is another one that's created in 1941. And we actually have the minutes of the meeting where the decision to set up the section was taken.
The subcommittee proposed that Mr. Morgan should be relieved of his duties in the military section from 1st of May 1941, and that then he should start working on the organisation of a research section. Colonel Tiltman said that three or four of the best students from the course would be available to join Mr. Morgan in the middle of May. Colonel Tiltman explained that Mr. G.W. Morgan had been put in charge of the research section with a staff consisting of one member from military section, two civilian cryptographers, Sainsbury and Tutt, Mrs. Bedshaw, and three French officers. The clerical staff consisted only of Mrs. Robinson. Major Pritchard had also done some work for the section.
Extracts from minutes of meetings held in April and June 1941 on the establishment of the research section.
We've heard there how Jerry Morgan is tasked to set up this section, and he's given three or four of the best students from the course. And the course is the cryptography course that John Tiltman has set up at Broadway Buildings in London and subsequently has moved to Bedford. And one of the people who goes on that course in 1941 is Bill Tutt, who has come from Trinity College, Cambridge, and will go on to be better known for his work on the Lorentz cipher and his contribution to Colossus. And that's something we've spoken about elsewhere. But his other claim to fame that people are less aware of is before he goes away and works on Lorentz and Colossus, he works on haggling. And I think this is a really interesting thing, because I've already referred to the fact that haggling has these adjustable pinwheels which have different lengths. And that's a very, very similar mechanism to the mechanism you see in the Lorentz machine.
So you think his work on haggling informed his work on Lorentz?
I think he kind of cuts his teeth on haggling so that when he goes on to address the problem of Lorentz, he's not starting from cold. There's components there, or there's aspects of the cipher that he's looking at and he's going, well, I've done this before.
Mm.
So I think when you look at his work on Lorenz, people tend to talk about it as this kind of blue sky genius that sort of a bolt from heaven comes down and tells him the answer. I think it's much more evolutionary than that, that he's done his course, he uses the skills he learns in his course to attack the stuff he does with Hagelin, and then he goes on and he takes that experience to this new problem. And I think that's how all cryptanalysts work. You start on the simpler stuff and you move on to the more complicated stuff. And the complicated stuff is informed by what you've done before. So I'm not saying that Hagelin and Lorenz are the same machine. They're not. The systems are vastly different in a whole host of ways. But they do things in their inner workings that are in some ways surprisingly similar. Biltas is set up with the problem of how do you read a Hagelin message?
And he's a fairly lowly new recruit.
Yeah, he's a temporary assistant clerk at this point, which is about as junior as you can get. There's about a dozen people in the research section. A couple of them are French guys. There's a chap rejoices in the wonderful name of Norman Cecil Sainsbury, who was formerly keeper of Oriental manuscripts at the British Museum. So again, you see the kind of the intellects they're bringing to bear. And actually, the research section has a list of a dozen or so different systems they're working on. They're attacking Vatican codes, they're attacking Irish codes, they're attacking some other German systems. So they've got a kind of whole menu of problems. Bletchley Park has basically gone, here's all the systems we don't understand yet being used by all these different people around the world. Off you go. And Tut gets given Hagelin. What you have to imagine also is not only Captain Morgan, but John Tiltman, who was ultimately in charge of the section. It gives you a little bit of an eye on just what a genius John Tiltman was, because he'll be in there and he's got 10 different people working on 10 different systems. And I'm fairly sure he'd be leaning over everybody's desk and go, how are you getting on? Have you thought about this? You know, sort of mentoring them and managing them.
Was he chief cryptographer by this time?
I don't think he's formally been appointed as that, but he's heading towards that role. He's already performing that role in practice. So you have to imagine Tut may be doing what Tut's doing, but Tiltman is keeping an eye on that. And he's also keeping an eye on all these people doing all these other things as well. You know, and he's doing Japanese naval attaché and he's doing all the other weird stuff he does. A real sort of hotbed of cryptanalytical activity.
It sounds like an amazing place to work.
Well, it'd probably be a lot of people writing endless lists of alphabets on pieces of squared paper and then swearing and going to get another cup of tea and coming back and starting.
Not visually very exciting, I would imagine. People at desks scratching their heads.
A lot of sweat and frustration as much as, you know, amazing breakthroughs. Mm. We talk very glibly about these things as if, well, Tut did this and then you did this and then you did that. And then look, clearly you broke the code. And you go, if this stuff were easy, it would have happened a lot more quickly. It's extremely hard work and it's tedious work of testing. You come up with an idea, you go, maybe it works like this. And because they couldn't stick it into a computer, they basically had a piece of squared paper and a pencil and they write out letters and try things and cut up the piece of paper into strips and waggle them about and then go, oh, that didn't work. And, you know, so it's an incredibly complicated process. But I can give you the distilled version of it, if you like.
Give us the headlines.
I'll give you the headlines. I think you might need your pencil and paper again this time because this is a bit like how the machine works. Assuming we know how the machine works, what's happening is the machine is taking our plain text, the content of our message, and is moving each letter forward through the alphabet by a different amount each time for each letter. And that's equivalent to adding on a second letter, if you like. So you can think of the key string, the conversions that are being done by the cipher, as either a string of numbers between 1 and 26 or as a string of alphabetical letters. But that string is 101 million numbers long, mm-hmm. but is fixed. So what you do is you look for two messages that either completely or partly overlap. And what you have there, you will have some plain text letters in both messages which have been offset by the same amount. So the number that's been added to them by the machine is the same. Mathematically, what that means is if you deduct one of those numbers from the other one, the plaintext 1 plus the key and plaintext 2 plus the key, if you deduct plaintext 1 from plaintext 2, you effectively cancel out the key. What you end up with is a number value or a letter, if you like, which is the sum of the two plaintext letters. And the cipher has disappeared completely. You've then got two messages effectively in plain text, but added together. Mm-hmm. So you can unpick that if you guess a word in the first message and see what letters that produces in the second message and whether it's gobbledygook or not. And if you find combinations that make sense in both messages, you can then unpick the two messages or that portion of the two messages. And so then you end up with some plain text. You then go back to your original ciphertext and deduct the plain text that you've worked out from that ciphertext. And that gives you the key string. The letters that have been added on, effectively, or the numbers between 1 and 26 that have been added on.
For the area where those two messages have overlapped. Right.
And if you do enough of that, if you get enough overlaps, you can build up quite a large portion of the original key string of the 101 million.
So you're seriously relying on these depths, these operator errors, these areas of overlap of the use of that code.
Or The other thing you do, if you've only got one message, but you can guess a crib for part of that message, you can do the same thing. You can work out, if you guess that your first letter is an A and the cipher letter is a D, then you know the offset is 3 or C, effectively. A plus C is D.
Were cribs used quite frequently?
Yes, cribs are used very frequently. And the Italians, one of the other errors they make is they use very stereotyped messages. One Tuck talks about, and Mavis Beatty talked about this for Enigma as well, the use of perk, P-E-R-K, because in the Italian language, the letter K almost never occurs. So they tended to use K as a word separator. So if you're writing your message, because there's no space bar,
yeah,
and all your letters are jammed up together, to separate the words, you just put a K between each word.
Makes sense.
And two in Italian, as in who the message is addressed to, pair, P-E-R. If you were writing, you know, to Naples, you'd put pair, K, Napoli, K.
Ah.
So a good guess for the start of a message is perk, is P-E-R-K. And if you offer that up, then you'll get some of the code string. And similarly, the headquarters, the Supermarina, would write the word Supermarina in their messages quite a lot. So, you know, it'd be pair, Napoli, from, I don't know what the Italian for from is, and then Supermarina.
That's quite a long word as
and
well.
And it's a big old long word. So cribbing is really important. We can all think about that part. That sounds quite straightforward. The clever bit, which Tut did next, is how you get from that to breaking a message. Because what you've recovered is this key string, this 100 million character list. That will have been created by the wheels at the front, the particular pins on the wheels at the front, moving particular flanges on the cage. But you don't know which is which in each case. But what Tut figured out is each wheel, if its pin is active, if the left-hand wheel has an active pin, then its contribution to the encryption, to the number of places that the letter is offset by, will be the same every time. The offset is varied because different wheels are active at different times.
Of the six.
Of the six. And to give you a basic example, the number of pins that were active on each wheel is always highest on the left and lowest on the right. And so, for example, if your left-hand wheel has 12 tabs or flanges opposite it on the bars, every time that wheel is active, every time its pin is sticking out, an offset of 12 will be created in the cipher. So if you have an offset of less than 12, you know that wheel can't be working. That pin must be switched off.
Yes.
And similarly, if you have an offset of 25, you know that not only that wheel is working, but a couple of the other wheels have to be working as well in order to get you up to 25. The tricky part, and the bit that Tut did that's really clever, is working out how many pins are active on which wheel in order to create that sequence of offsets, and when they're active and when they're not active.
In a reliable way that you can just apply this again and again.
Yeah, and then once you've got the key string worked out, once you've worked it out for that bit of string, once you've worked out where the pin settings are on the wheels, you can keep turning the wheels forever, if you like, and you can recreate the whole of the rest of the cipher from that point. But although in principle, knowing that each of the six wheels adds a fixed value to the offset sounds quite straightforward, actually, that the maths of working out what those individual offsets are is really, really complicated and requires quite a lot of trial and error as well. And that's the thing that Tut developed how to do. Using that, they were able to backtrack from that and work out what the W settings were, which is the tabs on the sliding bars in the cage, and also the X settings, which is the pins on the wheels at the front. They were able to work out both of those every month. From June 1941, the system that Tut's developed allows them to work that out usually within 2 or 3 days of the beginning of the month.
Wow. And they knew what day this would change over?
Yeah, it's calendar month.
Oh, beginning of the month.
Beginning of the month, it's changed. And the first time they do it is July 1941, I think, and it takes them until the 10th to get the answer. But after that, they refine the system, and it typically takes them a few days. And actually, in February 1943... we've heard about the bomb machines and Colossus. There's another machine that Bletchley develops called Nightingale, which was set up in Block A. And Nightingale is a device which works out the W and X settings for you every month, electromechanically, rather than you having to go through Tut's whole process. They were able to mechanize his X and Y setting process. So at the beginning of every month, they go in and they get some overlap messages and some cribs and things, and they punch it all into the machine, and it solves that for them.
Can you tell us more about Nightingale?
I can't, unfortunately.
Right.
We have very few references to this machine. We have one veteran who talked about operating it. She said it was a bit like playing a church organ. Mm-hmm. It sort of had a sort of keyboard and big thing. And we know what room it was in, but we know almost nothing else about it.
It's not survived.
There's no records, pictures. There's a couple of photographs in the GCHQ collection, which I think might be it.
Ooh, but
I can't prove it.
Right.
The label is just unknown machine, and I don't know enough about how it functioned to determine whether it is or not. Basically, it has the same bit of mechanism reproduced six times in the machine.
Right.
And it's a coincidence that the Hagler machine had six wheels on the front of it. That's the limit of my...
So Nightingale's a bit of a mystery machine.
Nightingale is definitely a mystery machine.
Right.
So what it means is by the summer of 1941 or the autumn of 1941, Bletchley is able to break these Hagler messages very, very readily at the beginning of every month. And it's at that point that Tutt is actually taken off this work and he goes off to start thinking about Lorenz in the back end of 1941, because the research section are no longer needed. They've come up with a methodology, and this is very typical of Bletchley. The Boffins have come up with a way of solving the problem, then that problem is shipped off to naval section, and a team are set up in naval section who just apply the solution that Tutt has developed.
And again, in similar ways to other encryption systems, someone eventually mechanizes that as well, and then that is dealt with by other people.
Yes, and so the Wrens in naval section can fire up the machine every month and they can churn out this traffic with great, well, not ease, but, you know, reliably every month.
Front North Africa. Panzer gehen vor. Stoßtrupps arbeiten sich vor und dringen in kühnem Angriff in die britischen Verteidigungslinien ein. Die harten und erbitterten Kämpfe in Afrika gehen weiter.
Marschall Rommel überreicht dem Panzergrenadier Günther Halm das Ritterkreuz zum Eisernen Kreuz.
Ich habe die Freude, Ihnen im Namen des Führers diese hohe Auszeichnung auszuhändigen.
Günther Halm ist erst 19 Jahre alt. Als Richtschütze einer Pack schoss er unter schwierigsten Bedingungen 7 Britenpanzer ab.
Ich bitte Sie zu dieser Auszeichnung und hoffe, dass Sie sie gesund nach Hause bringen. Wer so ein Kerl ist, der wird immer so ein Kerl sein, bei jeder Gelegenheit. Das erwarte ich natürlich von Ihnen.
Jawohl, Herr General.
So with the inability to read the book codes, which we mentioned quite a while ago, but with this newfound success in being able to break Hagelin fairly regularly, what were the consequences of that?
The consequences of it are really, really massive. It plays an enormous role in the ultimate Allied success in the Mediterranean and in North Africa in particular. In the first 6 months of the war, between June and December 1940, obviously the war's broken out in North Africa and the Italians launched an offensive into Egypt at that period. They supply their army by convoys across the Mediterranean from Italy to North Africa, and they lose only something like 2% of their ships. So it's very, very light damage to their convoys. It doesn't actually help them because their land forces do really, really badly. Operation Compass, the Italian army is defeated on land in 1940 fairly thoroughly, but they've got plenty of supplies because the convoys are working fine. As a consequence, in March 1941, the Germans send the Afrika Korps and Rommel. They're not the Afrika Korps at that point, they become the Afrika Korps, but the troops who will be the Afrika Korps and Rommel all go over to North Africa, to Libya, to support the Italians. And the Germans are able to make that troop and equipment lift to Tripoli with only minor loss. They lose about 10% of what they send. So at that point, up until the middle of 1941, the Allies and the British, we're talking about the British particularly, mainly at this point, in the Mediterranean, have not been able to do much about the German and Italian ability to supply North Africa. That changes in June. It's actually the 23rd of June, 1941, when the first Hagelin decrypt is sent out to Mediterranean commands. It would go to Cunningham in Egypt, for example, Mediterranean Fleet. Messages were also sent to Malta. As I said earlier, the W and X settings for July were broken by the 10th of July. And in the month of August, over 600 Hagelin messages were successfully read and passed on.
And passed on, we'd still call this Ultra?
This is still Ultra, yes. This falls under the heading of Ultra. And Harry Hinsley, who wrote the official history, who worked at Bletchley himself, described this. He said, from then on, GCNCS could give an advance warning of virtually every convoy and independent ship heading for North Africa. So such is the way the Italians are running their operations that Supermarina in Rome sends messages to the ports telling them what to do with the convoys that are going to North Africa. And that information is being read in sufficient time at Bletchley to get advance warning of all of those sailings.
So even though you'd said the 20 to 25 places using this Hagelin encryption, it's actually really crucial that it's those places.
Yes. Those messages are going to exactly the places we need them to go to. This traffic isn't trivial. It's very chatty as well. I mean, once they get going, they're breaking 3,000 messages a month. Even just between these sort of 20 plus locations, they're chatting away very vigorously about all of the different convoys that are being sailed. And these messages, they will list the ships in the convoy. They will list what day they're sailing on, which port they're sailing to, which route they're going to take, whether they're going to go to the west of Sicily or to the east of Sicily. All of this information is included in these messages. It's quite astonishing. And just in that early period from July to October 1941, the British are able to sink 180,000 tonnes of shipping, which is about 20%. So one in five of all the ships that are sent to North Africa get sunk, which is an unsustainable loss rate for the Italians, really. It's pretty massive. And if you consider, you know, a year previously, they were hardly able to affect this traffic at all. Mm. It's made a huge difference.
Does any of this traffic in decrypted form exist still?
Yes, we do have a number of messages, because all of the stuff that was sent from Bletchley to the Admiralty to the Operation Intelligence Centre survives in the National Archives in Kew. And the traffic was sent in various series, and you have the overall heading for the material is Z traffic. The Naval Section tended not to use the ultra term very much. They tended to call what they sent from Bletchley to the Admiralty was called Z traffic. And it's sent by teleprinter, so it'd be ZTP. And you see a lot of traffic is ZTPG, which is Z traffic, teleprinted, German.
Right.
But there's a whole separate collection, which is ZTPI, which is Z traffic, teleprinted, Italian. And those ZTPI messages, the majority of them are Hagelin intercepts. And so you can follow the attacks on these convoys in a lot of detail through those messages. And funnily enough, just last week was the 80th anniversary of one of the most significant intercepts of an Italian convoy that took place in November 1941. And the other thing you have to remember about this business is just reading the messages isn't enough. You have to have the military or naval resources to actually attack the convoy. You know, it's all very well knowing that there's a convoy sailing next week, but if you haven't got any ships or submarines to attack it, it's not going to make any difference. Mm-hmm. What is fortunate for the British is in the latter part of 1941, they were able to build up their naval resources in the Mediterranean, both in Alexandria and in Malta, to provide the means to act on this intelligence. The other question we always get asked at Bletchley is, how do you make sure that the enemy doesn't know you're reading his messages? Mm-hmm. And Hagelin gives us a really good example of how this problem was solved, because once they know these convoys are sailing, you can't just go and sink it because it starts to look a bit suspicious. But what they were able to do was send reconnaissance aircraft either from North Africa or from Malta. And it just so happens that those aircraft get told to search a particular patch of sea. Uh-huh. And oh, what a surprise, it has a convoy in it. And so the Italians are used to having their convoy sighted by aircraft, and they think that the British have a much bigger fleet of reconnaissance aircraft and a much better reconnaissance air reconnaissance effort than they actually do have. What they don't realise is a lot of these aircraft are being surreptitiously directed by Ultra to look in the right place. But also they get more ships, and in October 1941, Force K is created. And this is a group of Royal Navy ships, two light cruisers, HMS Aurora and HMS Penelope, and a couple of destroyers. And these ships go to Malta, and their job is basically to wait in Malta until they're told a convoy is coming, and then to go out and attack it. And in the first week of November 1941, a message comes in from Bletchley Park, which reveals that exactly such a convoy is going to sail.
0L1847/AL, 798/MA, 374. And for Army in Cairo. Emergency. An important convoy will be on its way to Tripoli during November 9 and 10, during which days the readiness of German bomber units based Greek area has been requested. Comment. This convoy probably left Naples this morning, November 8, and its route must pass east, repeat, east of Sicily. It seems likely to be the convoy with which Pisani, COL1835, was to sail. In which case, another convoy may have preceded it on the same route by about 24 hours. Escort of present convoy probably includes the destroyer Maestrale. Time, 2300 hours, 8th of November, 1941.
So this message talks about a convoy of seven merchant ships, which are a mixture of German and Italian ships, and two fuel tankers, Italian fuel tankers, which are going to sail to Tripoli from Italy. So perfect target. And they're carrying a huge amount of stuff. There's 1,500 tons of ammunition on there. There's 17,000 tons of fuel in the tankers. There's over 300 military vehicles. So it's a huge amount of stuff. Even though it's not a very large number of ships, it's still a huge quantity of war material going to.
And this bolsters the Italian and German
war effort. This is all for the German war effort in North Africa. Right. The force is also escorted by the Italian Navy. They make a pretty big effort. There's more warships than there are merchant ships. There's 6 Italian destroyers escorting the convoy itself. And they also have a shadowing force of 2 cruisers and some more destroyers. When they talk about shadowing force, the idea is you have naval ships that sail near the convoy, but because they're not directly escorting it, they have a bit more freedom of movement. And if there's a problem, they can go off and sort of attack independently.
I'm not really surprised if you've already told us 1 in 5 cargoes gets sunk on the way there. I'm not surprised this...
Yeah, the Italians get more and more desperate in what they do. They try and protect the convoys more and more. There are periods when it's getting so bad that they literally put oil drums on the decks of destroyers and send them across the Mediterranean because they're running out of merchant ships and they're losing so much stuff. The problem is if you stack the deck of a destroyer with oil drums and then that destroyer gets attacked, it's not good news for the guys on the destroyer. And that happens a couple of times. They also try putting supplies in submarines. You know, there's not a lot of space in
the
submarine.
Not spacious, I was going to say.
It's not a particularly efficient way of moving stuff. But anyway, this convoy sails, and as we've heard from the message, Bletchley is able to report this to the Mediterranean Command. They tell Force K in Malta, and Force K set out to intercept. HMS Aurora sighted the convoy just after midnight on the 9th of November, so middle of the night, and they come across this convoy with the merchant ships strung out across the sea with the destroyer escort sort of circling around it. The commander of Force K, Captain Agnew, manoeuvres his ships so that the Italians are between him and the moon, so that the Italian ships are all beautifully
backlit.
Silhouetted. They're backlit for him.
Right.
And he also has radar equipped ships, which is a really, really important difference in naval warfare, because if you've got gunnery control radars, you can shoot at night really accurately in a way you can't otherwise. It's a turkey shoot, basically. Force K open fire at 1:03, and by 2:05, he orders a ceasefire and they sail away. And in that just over an hour, all 7 merchant ships have been sunk and 1 of the Italian escorting destroyers. The destroyer escorts initially mistake the attacking British force for their own shadowing cruisers. So they don't shoot at them because they think they're on their side. Meanwhile, the cruisers that are supposed to be shadowing don't catch up and don't get involved in the fight. So there's a lot of confusion on the Italian part. But it's basically a massacre. The entire convoy is destroyed. And apart from a few shrapnel holes in a funnel, the Royal Naval Force suffers no casualties. It just sails away again. So if you talk about battles at sea in World War II, this is one of the most one-sided battles that happens in the whole war. And it shows the power of this intelligence that they can just sail up to this convoy, sink the entire thing, and sail away again. The Italians are understandably horrified by the whole thing. The 2 senior captains who are responsible for the escort and for the cruiser force are both sacked subsequently.
Not surprisingly.
Because even though they were surprised, even if you ignore the intelligence aspects of the story, they should have been able to fight off a British force that was half the size of their own force, basically. The British have got 4 ships. The Italians, they've got a dozen ships. Even if they're surprised, any competent naval commanders ought to have been able to make some impression on the British ships, but they just don't.
Is it a mix of circumstances? It's at night, the British were very aware of the location.
It's nighttime, the British have the advantage of gunnery radar. Part of the problem is the Italians, because they've got 2 forces involved, if it's dark and you've got your own ships out there somewhere as well, as enemy ships, it's very difficult to just shoot away going, all right, we'll just shoot at that. They don't know whether they're being shot at by their own side, they don't know whether they're shooting at their own side. So tactically, they don't do very well. It is a feature of these encounters, though, that while the Italian Navy has very up-to-date brand new ships, they're very good ships, their crews are relatively inexperienced and they don't have a lot of combat experience. So it's good kit, but not necessarily very well manned.
You did tell us at the start that the Supermarino was sort of all these lovely modernised ships and so on.
Yeah, but they've not done a lot of fighting.
Right.
And the fighting they have done hasn't been very successful. After Matapan, the Italian fleet basically stays in harbour because they don't want to take on the Royal Navy on a large scale.
Here we will stand and fight. There will be no further withdrawal. I have ordered that all plans and instructions dealing with further withdrawal are to be burnt. And at once, we will stand and fight here. If we can't stay here alive, Then let us stay here dead. I want to impress on everyone that the bad times are over. They are finished. Our mandate from the Prime Minister is to destroy the Axis forces in North Africa. I have seen it, written on half a sheet of notepaper. It can be done, and it will be done, beyond any possibility of doubt. What I have done is to get over to you the atmosphere in which we will now work and fight. You must see to it that this new atmosphere permeates right down through the Eighth Army, right down to the most junior private soldier. Great point to remember is that we are going to finish with this chap Rommel once and for all. Now, my forecast of this battle is that there will be three definite stages. First, the break-in to the enemy's positions, then the dogfight, and then the breakout. We will do the break-in on the night of the 23rd of October. The dogfight battle will then begin, and it will involve hard and continuous fighting. I believe that the dogfight battle will become a hard-killing match and will last for 10 or 12 days. The enemy will crack. Then will come the breakout, and that will lead to the end of Rommel in Africa. Make no mistake about that.
Did the Allies manage to maintain this level of success?
Not completely. I mean, one of the things that happens in the spring of 1942, the Duisburg convoy we've been talking about is in late 1941. In the spring of 1942, British fortunes in the Mediterranean really fall to their lowest ebb. And this is the period where Malta is under massive aerial attack by the Italians and the Germans. Famously, the island becomes one of the most bombed places in the world and is awarded the George Cross as an island. It's the only time the medal's been given to a place. And that story is quite famous of the siege of Malta and how it very nearly collapses. But the British fight their own convoys through to supply Malta. But the consequence of that is Force K has to leave Malta. You can't leave Royal Navy vessels in Malta because they'll just get bombed. So there's a period during the first half of 1942 where it's less possible to exploit this intelligence because the assets just aren't there at sea. And so the successes fall off. But by the time you get to the autumn of 1942, things pick up again. Malta is resupplied. You have, for example, the famous Operation Pedestal convoy where they managed to get fuel and supplies into Malta despite the Axis air attack. The other thing that happens in the summer of 42 is separately at Bletchley, they're able to break the Enigma key being used by the Africa Corps in North Africa, or one of its supply keys, a key which is codenamed Chaffinch at Bletchley. And what this does is it does two things. It allows Bletchley and the British intelligence to assess the impact of disrupting the convoys. Because the Germans, at the end of every month, they're sending messages over Chaffinch saying, this is how much petrol we've got, this is how many tanks we've got running, this is how much food we've got. You know, they're reporting on all of their supply situation. And most commonly, they're complaining about their supply situation. They're saying, we haven't got enough petrol, we're running out of this, we're running out of that. And the other thing that Chaffinch does is it contains information about what is being supplied in the individual convoys. Previously, the Hagelin information tells you that a convoy is sailing, it tells you the names of the ships, it tells you where they're going, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what's on the ships. Whereas the Chaffinch Enigma information tells you cargoes. And that allows the Royal Navy to really nuance what they're doing. So they can go, right, that convoy is full of food, but that convoy there has fuel or anti-aircraft ammunition or whatever, so we'll target that one. And it means they can nuance their attack and they can concentrate on the things in the convoys that the Germans are really short of and the Italians are really short of in North Africa. That means that this becomes doubly harmful for the Germans in North Africa. To give you some examples, Panzer Army Africa, which is what the Africa Corps becomes in 1942, reports via Chaffinch that it's only had 54% of its supply requirements for the month of September. So they're only getting just over half the stuff they need. And at the same time, they report they're only getting a third of the food they need. So everyone's getting pretty hungry. And this really constrains Rommel's ability to do anything in North Africa. At this point, the British are right on the back foot there at El Alamein, which is only 70 miles from Cairo. So had the Germans been able to launch a serious offensive from there, they could have captured Egypt and it would have been all over for the British in North Africa. But one of the reasons that doesn't happen is because of Rommel's supply difficulties. He literally doesn't have enough petrol. His tanks just can't do it.
which were a result of these convoys being attacked.
The results of the convoys
being
attacked.
Which is happening because of this intelligence.
Yes. And it's in that climate that in October, the Allies are able to launch what becomes the Second Battle of El Alamein, Montgomery's famous attack. And not only have the British been able to build up their resources in Egypt by convoys around Cape of Good Hope, sort of all the way around Africa. So Montgomery's been massively reinforced in tanks and men and equipment. At the same time, Rommel is really struggling for fuel and for ammunition and for everything, really.
This is hospital, but recording in the desert. The sound you can hear now is the noise of British tanks moving into battle. It's the night of Sunday, Monday, November 1st, 2nd. And it's the early hours of the morning, and here on this desert, with the sand clouds whirling up behind each vehicle, British tanks in large numbers are moving into battle. Shells by the thousands are being pumped into the enemy. And now here we are at the side of one of these desert tracks, watching the armed might of the Eighth Army go forward to engage the enemy. The moon, just half a moon, is shining down here, the starry night, and overhead there's not only the moon, but the flares which have been dropped, which are shining down on the desert and illuminating this battleground. Tank after tank is going past, just a few yards from the microphone as I speak now. One can't see very clearly. It's rather like being in a fog. It is indeed a fog, but the fog is a fog of sand, because the sand's very soft here, and each tank as it goes past churns up a great cloud.
As an example, between June and December 1942, 103 ships are sunk, 337,000 tons of shipping. And that represents 29% of the ships that sail. So nearly one in three ships is being sunk. And in December 42, that rises to 52%. So that's more than half the ships that sail are being sunk. This situation with all these ships being sunk means that Rommel's supply position is just unsustainable. The consequences are that his panzer divisions aren't able to counterattack during the Second Battle of El Alamein. Montgomery wins, and the inevitable retreat to Tunisia and then the final surrender in Africa in May of 1943 is a consequence of that. And the erosion of the German supply convoys continues right through that period, right up till May 1943. And in fact, that sort of December, January, February period, there's another famous incident, which we're going to talk about in our forthcoming exhibition, which is the Battle of Skirky Bank. And it's another situation where Hagelin intercepts have revealed an Italian convoy and ships are able to sail from Malta and almost entirely destroy that convoy. It's like Duisburg over again, if you like. Mm. And there are any number of incidents through that period where these convoys get really hammered.
So Bletchley's decryption of this Hagelin material provides really decisive intelligence.
It's really decisive intelligence. The caveat is always there that you have to have the Royal Navy ships in the right place to attack the convoys.
Yes.
And somebody has to do the fighting at the end of the day.
Exactly.
But it massively increases their capacity to do this. And it's a huge contributor to Allied victory in North Africa.
Britain's gallant Eighth Army roars over the ancient and arid terrain of North Africa to drive Rommel and his armies into the sea. General Fontoma, Rommel's second in command, routed out of Libya and with his back to the jagged walls of Africa's desolate coastal range, surrenders with his beaten and shell-shocked troops to the victors. Films captured from the Germans show Marshal Rommel at a more tranquil moment. Little did the Desert Fox then realize that the hunters were breaking through on all fronts.
So this Hagelin encrypted material, the machine is pretty compromised. Did the Italians stop using it? Did the Americans stop using it, as they had a model of it as well? What happened with this machine and its inventor, Boris Hagelin?
Well, the Italians stop using it when the Italian armistice comes in September 43, but they have used it right up to that point. Ironically, there is a moment when they become concerned about their cipher security, and the admiral in charge did an experiment, and he suggested that information about convoys should be taken by courier to the ports. And he has a sort of couple of weeks where he sends all the messages by courier. But for various reasons, the local commanders all protest and they say, no, what are you on about? You're claiming that we're a security risk. We're not a security risk. We're good, honest Italian admirals. Maybe it's the German Air Force that's the security breach. You know, And they have a period where they don't send any haggling messages and all their convoys get through unscathed. But bizarrely, they then abandon it and they go back to sending haggling messages again. I don't know what tells you about the Italian military psyche or their high command, but they could have solved the problem, but they don't. They carry on using the system right up until their surrender. And in fact, although the system is known to be weak, the effort that it's taking Bletchley to break these messages leads the US, for example, to think that for the purposes they're using their M209 machines, their haggling machines, they are secure enough for the job. Mm-hmm. And actually, the problem here is we go back to the original design that the French commissioned was a pocket cipher machine that can be used on the battlefield tactically, and that implies by relatively low-level troops. And for that, haggling is perfect because it's mechanical, it's easy to use, it's very quick, and it produces a cipher that is relatively secure. Mm-hmm. And if you're only using it for low-level battlefield communications, which only need to be secret for a matter of hours or days, then it's a perfect machine. The mistake is that the Italian high command take a machine that's suitable for that sort of low-level battlefield role and adopt it for a high-level strategic role where they actually need a much more secure system. And this is a feature of all codes and ciphers. It's a compromise between ease of use and complexity and security. And for a lot of purposes, you don't need a system that's highly, highly secure. You just need one that's easy to use and mm-hmm. is secure enough.
Secure enough, yeah.
For what you're doing. And actually, the M209 is secure enough for the Americans that they're not sending messages from Washington to, you know, command in Saigon on it. They're using it in the field in Vietnam. And there, it's perfectly secure. Mm-hmm. So Hagelin goes on. He moves his company to Switzerland and sets up there to avoid tax, which suggests how much money he was making. Mm-hmm. And he dies in 1983, a happy and wealthy man.
This business in Switzerland, is that what became called Crypto AG?
Crypto AG, yes.
Right.
For many years, it ran selling cipher machines all around the world. I mean, they continued on the same system. You get the C52, it's an update to the C38, but they also move into electronic systems, you know, digital systems, and become a world-leading cryptographic manufacturer. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, in 2018, people started to get a bit suspicious that something was going on. And it now turns out, due to various Freedom of Information requests in the US and investigative journalism by various people, that even when Hagelin was alive, he sold a controlling share in the company to a front company that was owned by the CIA and by the West German Intelligence Agency, the BND. And so for 20 years, from 1970 till about the mid-1990s, Crypto AG was being run by the CIA.
But he was making machines for the Americans.
He was making machines for the Americans, but more importantly, they were making machines for the Iranians, for the Libyans, for various African countries. And the CIA had arranged with the manufacturers, with Crypto AG, to provide what's called a backdoor, which is you adapt the system and the machine so that it makes it really easy for the CIA to read. So basically, Crypto AG was selling machines to various powers around the world in such a way that it allowed the CIA and the Germans and potentially the British and whoever else on the Western Allies to read those messages. And one of the ways they were doing this actually was the machine itself was not compromised, but the CIA had a guy writing the instruction manuals to insert procedural errors into how the machine was operated, which would allow the codes to be broken. And we've talked a lot about these kind of procedural errors with the Italians using Hagelin or with the Germans with Enigma or whatever. Mm-hmm. If you give someone the wrong instructions and they misuse the machine, then you're able to read their traffic. But then if somebody investigates the machine, they go, oh, no, this machine's absolutely fine. There's nothing wrong with it at all. But because the CIA have written the instructions. So there was a big scandal and the company and the brand Crypto AG still exists. It was bought out by another company in Switzerland. But its reputation is now quite substantially tarnished because there's this perception that it was selling dodgy cipher machines to all sorts of countries around the world.
And this is only a relatively recent discovery
of this.
This has
come out in the last, you know, few years. There were rumours and there were investigations and, you know, chatter, but it's only since 2018, I think, there was a formal inquiry into the whole matter.
But David, how far back does this go? The conspiracy theorist in me wants to know. You said, you know, 20 years or so. Do we have any evidence that there was activity earlier of supplying?
I don't know, to be honest, because it happened after 1946. It's not really part of my remit. My knowledge of Operation Rubicon, for that's what it was called, extends little further than Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if our listeners are interested in modern conspiracies, look up Operation Rubicon and you can find out all about how Crypto AG was actually owned by the CIA and Because there's questions about American politics being what it is. Ronald Reagan, for example, made a statement about reading message traffic from the Libyan government. Because there was a terrorist incident in Germany, and he got up and said, you know, we know the Libyans did it because we read a message from the Libyans. And everyone went, wait a minute, how did you read a message from the Libyans? Mm-hmm. They're using crypto AG encryption machinery. That all sounds a bit simple, you know. Because Reagan was trying to justify bombing Libya at the time. It's that problem that any sort of code breaking, although this is a different clandestine way of doing it, the problem with signals intelligence is don't let your politicians blab about it or boast about it because it gets you in trouble.
So there you go, listeners. For more information on this one, get hence and have a Google.
Go to your friend Google and look up Operation Rubicon and you'll find out all sorts of interesting, scandalous things about this. But yes, the Haglin company nonetheless, and Boris himself made a lot of money and lived happily ever after.
What work were you doing?
I was doing Italian Air Force and we were finding out bombers, where they were going and...
So you were doing really interesting work then?
Well, I suppose I was. You know, it was Air Force work. I was in the Air Force section. And we were doing the departure and the arrival in their various destinations, all these bombers and things from North Africa, intercepting them.
I mean, that was absolutely vital in 1941.
It was terribly exciting sometimes. I mean, the feeling in the office when you knew you were ahead of the timetable and they hadn't yet taken off, and you were able to get the message through to night fighters, and then they'd go up and shoot them down. And then, you know, there was a wonderful feeling of triumph. I never thought that the poor men were being killed.
So we should return to the Mediterranean in 1943.
Yes, having been distracted by the CIA. There's no doubt that the impact of this was huge, as we've described. But one of the aspects of it that I think is interesting is when we talk about signals intelligence, we so often talk about the protection of convoys in the Atlantic and the huge difference that breaking Enigma made to the protection of Allied convoys coming over from the US. And so we use phrases like, you know, saving lives and protection of food supplies and all of this. The situation in the Mediterranean is the direct reverse. Signals intelligence is being used to attack enemy convoys. It's being used offensively rather than defensively. And this is something that you need to remember about the work of Bletchley Park. That Bletchley Park, we talk about it in this very slightly comforting defensive way of, oh, as Eisenhower said in his letter, it saved thousands of Allied lives. It saves thousands of Allied lives at the expense of taking lots of Axis lives, you know, lots of Italians and Germans. And you look at the stats, it's quite astonishing. It's been calculated that the Italians had somewhere in excess of 700 merchant ships in use in 1940 prior to the war. 48%, nearly half of their merchant fleet has been lost by the armistice in 1943. So 50% of their merchant ships have been sunk. And an Italian historian looked at these figures because some ships are bombed in harbour, some ships are encountered by accident by a submarine, you know, all sorts of things. But an Italian historian, Alberto Santoni, looked at this. And he estimated that something like 35% of the losses of ships sailing to Libya could be attributed to Ultra. So there's a direct link between Haglin breaks and those ships being sunk. And he went further on the route to Tunisia, which is when we're talking about this latter part of the war in late 42, early 43. He reckoned it was something like 50% were sunk as a consequence of SIGINT, as a consequence of Haglin breaks. So you see the enormous impact this has. And by way of comparison, we talk about the Battle of the Atlantic and the Allied losses, and famously Churchill made all those remarks about the Battle of the Atlantic being the most important conflict. If you look at the most costly period for Atlantic convoys, which is in the sort of 1942-1943, when the Wolfpack attacks are at their height, it's been calculated that during that period, the Allies were able to make nearly 17,000 ship journeys across the Atlantic successfully. There's not 70,000 ships, there's one ship going more than once, but if you think about per ship per journey, nearly 17,000 successful journeys made for the loss of 308 ships. So that's a loss rate in terms of trips of 1.79%, so less than 2% of ships are sunk in proportion to the number of journeys they make. Mm-hmm. By comparison, in the Mediterranean, you've got 7,790 ship journeys and 1,278 ships lost, which is a 16% loss rate.
Crikey.
So that's nearly nine times higher than the worst loss rate in the Atlantic. And, you know, in Britain, we think of the losses in the convoys as tragic and terrible. And every one of them is if you're on that ship.
Yeah.
But it doesn't bear any comparison with the damage we're doing to the Italian merchant fleet. And similarly, if you look at the Japanese supply ships in the Pacific, and they had a system called the Water Transport Code. And when the Water Transport Code was broken by the US and by Britain again, there was a complete massacre of the Japanese merchant fleet in the same way. So SIGINT is important in the Atlantic in protecting Allied convoys, but it's arguably even more important in the Mediterranean and the Pacific in destroying enemy convoys.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.